It was the dawn of the third age of podcasting, 12 years after the B5 premiere. The Babylon podcast was a dream given form, its goal to discuss Babylon 5 episodes, arcs, and implications, to interview the cast and crew about their experiences and memories. It's a home away from home for fanboys, geek girls, and lurkers. It can be a silly place, but it's our last best hope for B5 fans. This is the podcast about the story of the last of the Babylon stations. The year is 2006. The name of this show is the Babylon Podcast.
And welcome back to another Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I'm Tim Callender.
Hey there, it's Jeffrey Willard calling from somewhere in the San Fernando Valley of beautiful, super hot California.
Yay, Jeff's back.
I missed you guys.
We missed you too.
Yes, we did.
Okay, so here's the deal, guys. Here's the deal. I'm calling you tonight. We're broadcasting. We're broadcasting from a local Mexican watering hole. I'm sitting here. I've got my feet perched. In fact, I think I'm going to take my shoes off. I am watching the traffic drive by on this busy San Fernando street. But I have a Dos Equis. I have myself some chips and some very hot jalapenos and some salsa. And Daddy deserves a break and an opportunity to sit here and talk with his friends.
All right. So what were you doing going out there that you would deserve such a wonderful treat?
I'm eating a chip right now. Just hold on a second.
Oh, okay. Well, talk amongst yourself.
I've been on a project that I was producing through my company in association with BBC. That, you know what? Our British fans are going to know about it. If you are a Babylon podcast fan and you are from the UK, I'm sure the name Jeremy Clarkson means something to you. And I've been doing a project that I'm probably not allowed to talk too much about, but I've been doing a project with Jeremy Clarkson, a famous journalist out in the desert. And here's the Babylon connection to this. This is what I've discovered. I have found out, I believe with all my conviction, that the shadows created the Mojave Desert. There is no place in the universe that could be more miserable, more horrible. Can I say really bad words? Can I say four-letter bad words on this thing? There is not one redeeming value about the Mojave Desert. And that's where I've just spent the last 10 days. I've just gotten back into town, and I am in desperate need of a large quantity of alcohol and perhaps an endless series of showers, because I think it's going to take weeks for me to get the dust and dirt out of places that I didn't even know you could put dust and dirt in.
It's a little slice of Zahadum right here on Earth.
Oh, wow.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And right now, I'm pretty sure that the Vorlons, in all their blessed goodness, created this little Mexican water hole because these peppers are great and this beer is nice and cold.
Well, Jeff, as we know, when John Sheridan went to Zahadum, he came back a changed man. What about Jeffrey Willard? Is he a changed man, having come back from the Mojave?
Let me spend the evening with my wife and I'll let you know.
That could go one of two ways.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe I'll have her call you.
Yeah, do that. We'd like to talk to her about this.
I mean, I don't want to brag or anything, but, you know, the desert definitely changes a man. I can tell you what, I'm physically different. I look like I was born in Puerto Rico or South Central America or something like that. I am so, and I'm out there with this entire British crew, and God bless these silly limeys. They come over here with their pure white skin after living the last 11 months in rain and clouds. And I kept warning them, you know, careful, we're going to the desert. Careful, we're going to the desert. It took all of about 7 minutes for them to turn bright red, all of them, you know.
Right.
Or something. Oh, here's a great story, too. I don't know if I should talk about all this stuff. anyway, you'll just get a kick out of this. I managed to almost get my entire crew arrested because we were inadvertently, I said, shooting some footage on a Edwards Air Force Base.
Oops.
Yeah, military didn't take too kindly to that behavior because I didn't have permission and I was out there with a bunch of Brits who didn't happen to have their IDs with them at the time. So, yeah. So here, I'd like to think that I'm a really good producer, but no, there's opportunity to learn every day.
Like, don't mess with Uncle Sam. Mm.
So that would have been a bad time to break out a George Hamilton impression. It's like, no, we're shooting some more crispy toasted Doritos commercials.
Those boys took that stuff serious, too. They were not kidding around, you know, as it should be. I mean, they were in their total right. that got my attention. That was a high point in my career.
Well, as they say, good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment.
Wow, that's a twisty Vorlon statement if I ever heard one.
I thought my Vorlon response would have been that, you know, I just had a silver tongue and flames coming out of my ass was the only way I got out of the whole thing. But... anyway, what have you guys been doing? What have you been talking about for the last couple of weeks?
Oh, we've been playing up the geek side of it to the hilt.
Yep, shock and amazement.
We've gone through a handful of, we've gone through two or three episode reviews, and I think tonight we're going to crank through a couple more.
Yes, we are.
Try to move some things along. And then, of course, we've got some interesting emails, Jeff, that I think...
Well, you go. That's great. Listen to that boomer. Can you hear these cars going by?
I hear the chips crunching.
Yeah. I hear the glug-glug of the beer.
Oh, yes, there's a lot of that. I'm going to have to go get another beer here in a minute, so you guys can join me as I go in and order another Dos Equis.
Okay.
Okay, then we will take a quick break and jump into some episode discussion right after this.
Firepoint Media, in conjunction with DragonCon, America's largest multimedia popular arts convention, presents Podcasting Now and Beyond, a celebration of portable media programming bringing together the full spectrum of podcasters and their audience, from pros to first-timers, for a conference of information and entertainment. Join us for panels, seminars, workshops, and events culminating in the Parsec Awards, honoring podcasting excellence and speculative fiction. Visit our website at www.parsecawards.com to join us in podcasting history. Podcasting Now and Beyond, September 1st through 4th at the DragonCon Convention in Atlanta, Georgia. Your future to the power of beyond.
And we're back, jumping sort of in to the middle of season one, or it's the middle.
Yeah. The next episode in line is TKO. In this particular episode, you have two concurrent stories. One involves the arrival of Walker Smith, a down-on-his-luck prize fighter, who's come to B5 to participate in the Muay Thai, which is a blood sport that humans have been excluded from. And at the same time, we have the arrival of Rabbi Kozlov, who is on the station to convince Susan Ivanova to sit Shiva for her dead father. The one thing, upon reflection about this episode, this one comes right after the big mega blockbuster for season one, which is Signs and Portents.
Mm-hmm.
And on the one hand, you might want to say that it suffers because, you know, there's not even really an A story and a B story. It's two kind of personal stories. So, it kind of gets lost in that glare, if you will.
Yeah.
But having said that, it's an extremely uneven episode, in my opinion.
Explain uneven.
Well, I was much more attracted to the Ivanova story. I found that to be very personal and very moving, especially the scenes where she is, as she's sitting Shiva and talking about, reminiscing about her father. And, you know, up to this point in the relatively short run of the show, we've come to know that, and even in the beginning of this episode, we find that he was distant from Susan and didn't give her the love that she felt she needed or deserved. But in reminiscing about her father, comes to realize that he was probably there for her more than she realized. And especially the last bit there where she thanks everyone for coming, and she basically breaks down because she allows the walls to fall and she can mourn. I thought that was excellent and great acting on Claudia Christian's part. On the other hand, the story of Walker Smith going to fight in the Muay Thai just seemed really hackneyed, I have to say. You know, it's the down on his luck prize fighter. One big fight will get him back in, and, you know, all the fighters, the alien fighters, don't want him there, and then there's just the one guy who comes along and believes in him, and he gets in there and slugs it out and wins the respect of everybody. And even beyond that story, I think the way it was cut between the two stories really took away from any impact that they might have had. You know, we start seeing Susan reminiscing about her father, and then we're cutting over to Walker Smith getting ready to go into the ring. And then we cut back to the rabbi talking about Susan's father. And then we cut back to human and alien exchanging blows. And then we cut back to, and it just never seemed to allow any particular drama in either story to develop as well as it could have.
Mm-hmm. I kind of had a less than pleasant reaction to both stories. I understood the reason for the cutting back and forth, but I really, really couldn't get myself to care a whole lot. There, like you said, there was no drama building up in either storyline. I like that we found out a lot more about Susan. I like that we found out how much she missed her father, you know, the man who she knew as her father after her mother died, because he just went into a shell. I liked how we see a softer side of her. We finally see her as a human and not a strict by the book, you know, military robot. I mean, we saw a little glimpse of that in War Prayer, but now right. We really, really see it. You know, we see, okay, she's been holding back a lot. She's been dealing with a lot of repressed grief, repressed anger at her family. Okay, all right. It's I don't know. As she said in several episodes, it's a Russian thing.
Right.
And I understood what they were trying to do with the whole Muay Thai line storyline. I'm just the fight was choreographed pretty well. You know, as someone with some fighting experience, I could see what they were going for in the way they shot that fight. The crowd seemed to be not all that lively.
Right.
And yeah. I don't know if that's just that they wanted to portray that as like an aliens respecting the Muay Thai, or I don't know what they were going for. I really, really don't know what they were going for. And it just lost me, because it didn't look like all of the people watching the fight were involved. And if you've ever watched any kind of fight, the people watching, you know, you see them really, really, you know, getting in there, you know, mentally anyway.
Yeah. I think that the one interesting idea that was presented with the Walker Smith story was the idea, there's the one alien that comes to Smith after he's, you know, made the challenge, and he basically says, you know, you Earthers, you're everywhere, you touch our planets, you come to our colonies, the Muay Thai is ours, you stay out.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love to have seen that explored more. You know, we've touched on it some with Jakar and some of his enmity toward humans, as embodied with his adversarial relationship with Sinclair. we kind of hear it. Oh, we definitely hear it with the League of Non-Aligned Worlds,
mm-hmm.
especially in Deathwalker. So I think they could have really explored much more of that enmity, and they didn't. It was very, very cursory.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it basically boiled down to one guy, and he was going to shoot Walker in the back, and Garibaldi puts an elbow in his nose.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think
and that's the end of it.
Yeah, I think it would have been, it would have had a little more impact if we had seen, like, just dropped in a couple of other episodes, you know, Muay Thai match tonight, you know, and we'd see a whole lot of excitement in the alien community, and the humans are going, what is this?
Right, right, exactly. Yeah.
So just to, like, at least tease us about it, you know, bring it in, little thing about a Muay Thai here, little, you know, even a little tiny ISN interview with a Muay Thai fighter, you know, a Muay Thai Drazi, you know, so a Drazi who's in the Muay Thai. It's like, oh yeah, so-and-so has a fight tonight in the Muay Thai and
sure.
blah, blah, blah.
You can even run that in the background in the Zocalo while two other people are talking.
Exactly, exactly.
Items. Yeah,
agree. build a thread through the episodes we've already seen so that this isn't one standalone throwaway. I understand they wanted to get sports into Babylon 5 because sports is part of what we do. We compete. Friendly,
right.
unfriendly. We got the World Cup going on. Half the
right.
world not watching anything else.
Right, right. That's the global Muay Thai, I think
yeah.
you could say. I thought a lot of it seemed really cliched too. The Muay Thai Do with sort of the bogus accent. You know, I don't know if it was supposed to be sort of the Oriental.
Actually, that's how he really talks.
Oh, really?
That's
okay.
That's Sun Tech O. That's how he really talks.
Interesting, interesting. You've got Caliban, I believe the character's name is, who helps Smith train for the Thai. You have, I understand, I went to the Lurker's Guide. Walker Smith was the real name of Sugar Ray Robinson.
Right.
Okay, so that's a very interesting tie-in. But at the end, when they start chanting the name over and over again, Smith is such an anonymous name.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it really came off really cheesy. You know, and that was just me. And here's another one. I didn't want to go back and watch it again because I was not particularly impressed with this. But correct me if I'm wrong, Summer, but in that scene when they're watching the fight, Garibaldi is in his Earth Force uniform, correct?
No, he's not.
Okay, that's because I happened to notice at the end when he's chanting and holding up Smith's arm in the ring, he looked like he was wearing his civvies.
He was wearing that shirt, that sort of dress shirt that
right.
we've seen him eat, you know, having dinner with that shirt and the
right.
the slack. So it looked like he was wearing half of his Earth Force uniform, but no, he was in civilian
okay.
dress there.
All right, then I wasn't paying as close attention as I should have, and I apologize.
Yeah, but I think the one real thread that carried through this episode was somebody else, a good friend of Garibaldi, telling him to watch his back. It's just one other little poof foreshadow
yeah.
thing stuck
right.
up there.
Right.
You know, we have Walker Smith saving Garibaldi from a shot in the back, and then as he's leaving, he says, "Watch your back."
Yes, that's right.
Yep.
That's right. Yeah. So on one other last note, Theodore Boechel was the actor who played Rabbi Kozlov.
Mm-hmm.
And Susan referred to him as Uncle Theodore, or I can't remember, it was a couple of weeks since I watched it. I didn't take notes. I apologize again. He is also the same actor who played Worf's adoptive parents on Star Trek The Next Generation.
I did not know that.
Yeah, I that was another thing I Googled because I recognized that I had to find out. Well, does that mean that it's some relation that Susan Ivanova and young Worf might have crossed paths?
I think
I'm just
you're
asking.
Stretching it. Oh, no, I see a really, really, really painful crossover fanfic in the making.
Well, I'm sure it's out there somewhere. And if anybody wants to point out that link to us, please send it on thebabylonpodcast@gmail.com. I have no further comments about this episode. How about you, Summer?
No, I don't. I do not.
Okay.
It really is I wonder if this episode would have held up better had it not fallen right after Signs Importance. I don't know.
I don't know. I think maybe, but I think it's just generally a weak story.
Yeah. Okay, we're done.
All right.
We will take a quick break and come back with some discussion on Grail, episode 15.
Grasshopper, you have learned much in your training. However, to achieve ultimate geekness, you must pass one final test. You must snatch this chip from my hand, Grasshopper. I wasn't looking. You must snatch this chip from my hand. Once again, you must snatch this chip from my hand. You must snatch this chip. Enough!
Learn from the true masters. Visit kickassmysticninjas.com.
And welcome back for more episode discussion on the Babylon Podcast. We are up to episode 15.
Yes, this episode entitled Grail. In this particular episode, a seeker comes aboard the station carrying out the wishes of his order to try to find the Holy Grail of legend. Meanwhile, there is a lurker down below running a crime ring, and he's using something that might be Ambassador Kosh to threaten and coerce lurkers. And of course, the two do meet later on. Summer, what's your general impression of this particular animal?
I liked this episode. There was a lot more depth in this episode about how you consider yourself, you know, personal perception of who you are versus letting other people's perceptions of who they think you are define your life.
Sure. That would be embodied by Jinxo, the
yes.
Lurker who believes that he is the Babylon curse. In the episode, he is a space construction worker who's worked on all five stations, and after the sabotage of the first station, he came back and worked, and after the sabotage of the second station, he signed up to work on the third one, and that one blew up. The fourth one burned down, fell over, then sank into the swamp. But the fifth one stayed.
Yes.
And he is convinced that he needs to stay on the station, because otherwise something terrible is going to happen. Of course, he's sort of stuck in a rock in a hard place because he owes Deuce, the crime lord down below, some serious cash, and so he can't just run because he truly believes that if he leaves the station, something dreadful is going to happen, but his life is also at stake. And he makes friends with Aldous Gajic, who is the seeker looking for the Holy Grail, who manages to convince him that he is worth more than what other people perceive him to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with you. I thought there was some very interesting comments. I like the scene where Thomas Jinxo is describing his career with the Babylon Project and says, "You see, I'm the Jinx," and Aldous looks at him and says, "No, I think you're very lucky. You managed to be away when these dreadful occurrences happened, and you managed to survive."
Mm-hmm.
There's a moment he goes, "You know, I've never thought of it like that." And I think that's it. I think that's kind of the essence of it.
Just the fact that you have one man seeking for something, he's carrying on his order. There is no more order besides him.
Right.
He's the last one. He is diligent in his quest to find the Grail. And even if he doesn't find it, his life is richer. because of the journey he's decided to take. It's not about it's not about the destination, it's about the journey. And he is making the best journey he can by being true to himself and trying to find this object. And it really is a grail. It is a grail for his quest to find whatever, peace,
right,
himself, the hope of mankind. And it's his, what is it, true seeker is revered in Minbari culture.
Oh,
and
that was going to be my point. I really enjoyed that aspect of it. When the scene in the Zocalo where Garibaldi and Sinclair are sitting down to have a bite to eat, and Delenn, not really incensed, but kind of affronted that Sinclair doesn't realize that they have this great seeker. You know, as she says, I didn't think there was one like you among your people. And you should have you should be there to
honor his arrival.
And Sinclair, I think, at the first, treats him with respect because that's just how he is. But at the end, I think he truly comes along to understand, as you say, that it's the journey and not the destination. You know, there's. As he tells Delenn, you know, well, it's just a legend. You know, if he wants to look for it, that's fine. But, you know, I there's no reason for me to take him seriously.
Right.
And Delenn basically says, you know, no, you don't get it. You know, and they treat him that way. They don't treat, you know, the Minbari don't treat him sort of, you know, like, you know, he's the crazy uncle and we'll humor him. You know, Delenn is serious when she says, you know what, we're going to search our records and I'll let everyone know that you're looking for this thing, and if we find it, we'll bring it to you.
Right.
You know, and I thought that was good. I think that was an interesting angle on the spirituality of it. And I like Delenn's line to Sinclair after they first meet Aldous, to the effect of, you know, are you sure he's the only person who's looking for something? You know, or God, I can't remember exactly what it is.
Yeah, she said it's something that's like, I believe the same is true of you, or something like that.
Right, right. And he's like, what do you mean? She goes, well, maybe you don't know yourself as well as you think you do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was good. You know, it's interesting, and looking at the Lurker's Guide and looking at the JMS Speaks section, there is the last entry from JMS that says, no, this isn't a particular ARC episode, except there were lines like that in it. And, you know, and I wonder if that at the time was a bit of misdirection on the Great Maker's part.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's technically the first episode where we get a hint of what happened to B4.
Right.
You know, they just said it disappeared. Well, define disappeared.
It got all wavy and disappeared. Yeah.
Just poof, gone. And right. Then I think it leads to a few other, like hints to a few other things that happen later.
Right.
But like the mystery, like the whole episode, the whole trail with Jigsaw being linked to the underworld guy and their run in with the guys in the court. I mean, the judge, the ombudsman, as they call him, that's hilarious. Right. The very first thing you see him, he's like, I my complaint is his great grandfather kidnapped my great grandfather, and we want damages.
Yes. And how do you respond to that? And the alien holds up
the
pictogram. Yes.
And he complains. Yeah, he complains. He says, why doesn't the other guy get these cases? Why do I get these cases?
Right, right. I enjoyed that. That was funny. But I will say the subplot, I guess it's a subplot, with Deuce having the Nakalim feeder. I don't know that there was any tension built by hiding it in Kosh's encounter suit.
No.
You know, I mean, as a viewer, well, let's take a different step. In terms of, as Sinclair tells Kosh later on, that he was using it as a way to intimidate the other lurkers and to kind of puff up his own position, saying, I've got, you know, the Vorlon ambassador in my pocket. We never really see that has that effect. you know, any reaction you're getting is not that, oh my God, it's Ambassador Kosh coming to kill me. It's this weird tentacle thing is going to
suck my brain out. Yeah.
And that's two different things right there. So, you know, plot-wise, it's you gain nothing from it. And as a viewer, if you've been watching the show, you know instantly by looking at it, well, that's a dummy encounter suit. You know, there's no drama built up with, you know, is it really Kosh? Of course it's not. We know it's not.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was kind of pointless. Now, what was your take on the fact that the Nakhleen Feeder did not attack Aldous?
My take on that was his presence, he knew himself, he wasn't afraid. He wasn't afraid. I think that fear attracts it and draws it in, and
right.
he was not afraid of it. He said, you will not harm these people, they are under my protection. I've seen people break up a bar fight with a look, literally. So I believe in that kind of presence. If like people have that, you just stand up and go, stop. I'm inserting myself into the situation. You will stop right here, and they stop. There's just an energy, a presence there where you're like, whoa, what was that? And so that's what I believe. I don't think he had any special powers. He just knew himself. And just was not afraid, and was willing to put himself in harm's way to save somebody else.
Right, I agree with you. And with that, it's an interesting reversal with Londo's reaction when Sinclair comes to him and says, "What do you know about the Nakhleen Feeder?" And he completely wigs out. You know, so I mean, on the serious note, that plays into the theory that the Feeder feeds on the fear. You know, and the Centauri have had a history of it, and so, you know, it would love Centauri's brains at that point. You know, they're fraught with fear. But that little humorous sub-subplot was a lot of fun. I really liked that. You know, here you got Londo, who even when dealing with Aldous in the search for the Grail is trying to fleece him. When it comes to the Nakhleen Feeder, not only will he be cooperative, he'll be amazingly cooperative, and he's going to be completely out of eyesight and not stirring up trouble for anyone.
Like, I'm not coming out.
Well,
you know,
right.
Are you sure it's dead? They're very tricky, you know.
That's right, right. Yeah. Yeah, I love Garibaldi's response to, yeah, you know, the doc says it looks like it's quiet. And then he walks away, just, you know, Lana swings back into his quarters. We veer out in the hall. It's awfully quiet now. This isn't funny.
I actually like that because it was his turn to dig on Londo after they had done the thing with Jakar, you know, the beep beep, the little the non-existent tracking device.
Right, right, yeah, yeah. So that was enjoyable. That was very enjoyable.
Yes,
and it was comic without being buffoonish, which I liked.
Yep. I don't know. I liked that whole. Londo's overreaction to it all.
Yeah.
Running out of the casino, leaving his money there.
That's right. And his drink.
<It's gone. laughs>
Yeah. That's good fun.
Mm-hmm.
Good fun.
What did you think about Jinxo's transformation?
You know, it was all right. I mean, you could see it coming. To a certain extent, you know, I wouldn't go so far as to say it was cliched in that way. You know, certainly I think it was a touch cheesy at the end when, you know, he's leaving the station and Garibaldi says, "Hey, Jinxo, you know, good luck to you." And he goes, "No, my name is Thomas." Having said that, though, I like the interplay between Thomas and Aldous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, David Warner is just a great character actor. He's been in everything.
Yeah.
And he brought just the right amount of gravitas and wisdom to that role, which I think played really well because, you know, here's Jinxo at that point, completely uncertain of himself. You know, the only thing he's really hanging his identity on is the negative. You know, and Aldous comes along and convinces them and shows them in a very real sense, you know, here's how you can live your life. And that's where the transformation comes. You know, it's some talking and whatever else, but I think the scene where Aldous stands up to the theater is probably that moment where Thomas realizes this is how you live your life. You know, that part, that it is about the journey, and it is about finding what you believe in and standing up for it.
Mm-hmm. And see, I had a different reaction. I thought that Jinxo saying that, you know, my name is Thomas, was actually the final break. Because remember, he said everybody else started calling him Jinxo, and now he's saying, no, I am not Jinxo, I am Thomas. I just thought the whole transformation happened a little fast, but I guess you could chalk that up to him being shocked back to himself by seeing Aldous, by having Aldous die basically in his arms.
Right. Well, you're also dealing with 40 odd minutes of story.
True.
You know, so, and I guess that's part of the, maybe one of the issues I have, generally speaking, with the first years of episodes of B5 as opposed to the later stuff, is once the show is really up and running, and again, we're dealing with hindsight here, but once JMS is able to work character development across the span of 6-7 episodes, 2-3 years, those kinds of transformations become much more believable, because it is a matter of tales being layered upon as time goes on.
Right.
And, you know, I guess in the first year you don't have that luxury. You just got to get the show up and going and prove to the studio, hey, it's a viable thing, and keep it going so that you can do that. And I understand that. But having said that, again, it's going to seem abrupt, because you're doing it in the span of, you know, within an hour, as opposed to many hours of viewing. So, you know, kind of a tough road to hoe, perhaps.
Yeah, I guess so.
And you know, we're also dealing with it in retrospect here. You know, we've been able to see the entire 5-year arc unfold and see some of the amazing storytelling and character development and acting that went on. So by comparison, you know, this doesn't look as strong, because we know Franklin's dealing with Stims. I mean, think about how that built up.
Yeah.
You know, Sheridan's transformation, even, and we're talking even before he goes to Zahadum. You know, he comes to the station as sort of a happy-go-lucky guy, and at the end of just that first year, you know, he tells Gosh, I don't want to learn about you anymore. I want to learn how to fight him.
Yep.
You know, and that's a difference. But that happens over the course of 20 episodes.
Right, of time. And I have to agree with you about David Warner and just being a great presence as an actor. It's completely a coincidence that I watched this I rewatched this episode within 2 days of rewatching the original The Omen, which he's in. I was like, whoa, that's kind of interesting, right, there.
Right. Oh, and think of all the various Star Trek movies and episodes that he's been in. And God, I'm trying to think of what else he's been on. Fair amount of genre stuff, you know. He's just one of those guys, and good at everything he does, you know. I mean, you know, whether the script's good, bad, or indifferent, he is a professional that way.
Cool.
Yeah. So
any other comments?
Well, I was just gonna say the final shootout with the feeder lacked any sort of intensity or drama, I thought. You know, the thing's kinda creeping around and sucking people's brains out, and you know, again, it kind of gets back to the whole, you know, it wasn't a particularly frightening creature other than the occasional seeing people getting their brains sucked out. It just wasn't. I guess I'm just not a monster movie kind of guy. I mean, Alien worked, but you really think about that one, that built over time, and there were other things going on in it.
Do you think that there was a difference in that creature being all CGI rather than something in a costume?
well, the sucker tendril thing was a practical prop.
Yeah, but at the end where you saw the entire creature.
No, because I think they did a fairly good job through most of its revelation keeping it in the shadows. You know, you'd see a tendril here, you'd see part of like the head sack thing here or there. No, I just think that it was the way the script was going. I just think it didn't have any kind of drama. It didn't have the right kind of creepiness. Part of it, I think, was the whole Kosh subplot thing that went nowhere. You know, I mean, you know, it was trying to play off the idea that we don't know what's in the encounter suit, and Sinclair even comes back to that. And I like that scene.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. It was dressed like you. Why? We guess because it was trying to, you know, the Deuce was trying to make everyone think you were part of whomever. Why? You know, and that was, you know, just much more profound. You know, listen, of course, Kosh is just great that way. You know, one word. And as he said, you know, well, you know, everybody, nobody knows what's in there. We're kind of frightened about what we might find. And Kosh goes, good. You know, that, see, to me, that was creepy.
Kosh was more creepy than the Nocoline feeder.
Sorry? Yeah.
I said, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. But that's because it's much more, I hate to say animate, but it is. And, you know, I don't think it was the CGI creature. I don't think that at all. You know, it wasn't that it looked like a bogus monster. I think what they were trying to do with it, I'm not sure that they had a sense of what they were really trying to go for. And that final shootout, I mean, there just wasn't really any energy in it at all. You know, it was the good guys come in at the nick of time and... You know, Aldous throws himself in between his apprentice and the bad guy and takes the bullet for him in his, you know, in his dying wish. You know, it's the end of the order, and Thomas says, no, I'll take up the mantle. I mean, it's just kind of, yeah, okay, whatever. So
good old-fashioned Old West shootout.
Yeah, and I took my cynical pill today when I watched it, but it was just, oh, yeah, another shootout, okay. Good guys win, yeah.
Okay.
Any other thoughts that you have on this?
Nope, that pretty much covers it.
Great.
All right, so take a quick break here and be right back with some listener feedback.
Have your kids read any good books lately?
No, tell me more.
Hi there. This is Sheila, and I'm here with my co-host, Lori. We are two middle school teachers with a passion for books, here to invite you to check out our show, The Dragon Page, with class.
Our show is geared toward parents and educators who are looking for frank, open discussion with the authors of some great books we are constantly recommending to kids.
We also talk about what's happening in our classrooms, tips and tricks for parents to use on their reluctant readers, and some occasional grumblings about the state of education.
So if that sounds interesting to you, check us out at dragonpage.com for The Dragon Page with Class with Sheila and Lori. Yes, it's another Farpoint Media production.
www.dragonpage.com.
Hi, this is Julie Caitlin Brown, the top of Babylon 5, and you're listening to the Babylon 5 podcast.
And we're back, and we're going to hop into a little listener commentary. Do we have any voicemails this week, Tim?
We did not have any voicemails.
No voicemails. Any interesting emails for Jeff?
Well, perhaps.
Perhaps.
Let me read this. This is certainly, undoubtedly, one of the most interesting emails that we've ever received here at the Babylon Podcast. This comes from Henry Coleman. Henry writes, "Dear friend, I know this email will come to you in an odd manner as you have not received any prior communication from me before now. But be that as it may, my name is Mr. Henry Coleman, and I was privileged to be the account officer of my deceased client who lost his life some time ago. In the process of review of the financial report by my bank, I discovered that both of you have a similar last name. Hence, I contacted you so that I can give you further briefing on my intention and how to disperse the estate you left behind." If there's anyone out there listening whose last name happens to be Podcast, we can forward on Mr. Coleman's query to you. So,
you know what? I go away for a couple of weeks, and the next thing I know is Tim's on here reading spam to us about maybe some Vioxx ads or something like that, how to get Canadian drugs across the border. What happened to the...
Well, Jeff, you know, I didn't know whether you might have changed your last name out there in the Mojave Desert. Your brain got baked, and so you thought it would be a good idea to take him an alias or what?
That's a great idea. I should start doing that. Dear Tim,
the Mojave Desert.
I think Summer is so hot. Please send me a picture of her. Love,
and like
Pop.
And like I tell everyone who asks for those questions, go to the website, look at the show logo, and Summer's the one in the middle.
Yep. And I'm not holding out on the Babylon podcast listeners. I tell the Winging It crew, the listeners, the same thing. They're like, when are we going to see a picture of you? You're not.
I'm going to have to call Jason Carter and get him in here for two more shows, because this is just going nowhere now.
Okay, well, let's pick up on another one here. Okay, you ready? This is from David Boyer. He says, I just finished listening to show 20. It reminded me of something that I have been going to write since the first show, okay? So I'm a procrastinator. You ask, what got you hooked on B5? I started watching it a few episodes in and had watched it 2 or 3 weeks, but it was not that into it. Then on one of the episodes, I don't remember which one, Sinclair and Garibaldi go into the restroom together. They stand behind a wall, zip down, do what they need to do, zip up and clean their hands under an ultraviolet light. I looked at that in amazement. It was the first sci-fi show that I ever remember seeing that people actually went to the bathroom. I decided I had to start watching the show more earnestly to see what other innovative things they were going to do. From there on, I was hooked on the story itself, the arc, and all that went along with it. This may sound weird, but this is really what got me watching the show. How about that, Jeff? Is that better for you?
That just goes to prove shit happens in space.
That's exactly right. And I think we have a couple other restroom scenes later on in the show. There's a scene with Sheridan and Garibaldi. I believe actually in Divided Loyalties, they go into the restroom and make sure all the stalls are empty before they start talking about maybe bringing Talia in.
That is correct.
Yeah.
And then there's also the my favorite, where Garibaldi's bored out of his skull during the long flight to investigate where Babylon 4, the signal from Babylon 4 is coming on. So he says, so what do you do first, fasten zip or zip then fasten?
We are not having this conversation.
Yes.
I don't know if it was in a show or not. I don't remember this, but I'm sure it's in some manual or RPG game or something somewhere. I'm sure there's a whole science behind the sewage waste system of Babylon 5 and how we probably had some clever way of recycling everything to create weapons or power or something like that. I feel sorry for anybody that had to process Pachmarab poo, but...
Well, they were carrion eaters, so you know what's probably coming out of that.
Well, see, I don't know if they ever went into detail on Babylon 5 about the waste processing endeavors, but there was actually a little, like almost a B storyline or a side effect of a B storyline in Crusade about that, where in one part of the ship, you know, Gideon kept smelling something foul and he couldn't figure out what it was.
Yep. Right.
That was hilarious. That whole little line was just hilarious to me anyway.
And just as a matter of historical precedent, in 2001, A Space Odyssey, we're treated to a brief shot of Haywood Floyd on board the shuttle heading toward the moon, I believe, where he's sitting in the zero-gravity toilet and reading the directions. And I actually happened to see the instructions for use of the zero-gravity toilet. I've got a making of 2001 book, and it's printed out, and it's none of the sort of the in-joke stuff that you found on Star Trek or any of those. You know, nobody can read it. They actually printed out fairly detailed instructions of what you're supposed to do to make that thing work.
That's funny.
Yeah. So on
wrong.
That note,
yeah, you're really socking them to us today, buddy.
Hey man, you know I've been holding back on you. We're letting go now. Here we go. This is from Valerie. "Hey guys, thanks for another podcast. My husband and I have really been enjoying eating our dinner on Wednesday nights and listening to the great discussion." But first of all, if you're listening to us while eating dinner, I'm questioning your judgment. But that's beside the point.
I'm flattered.
I'm having chips and dips here.
Very good. Very true. Valerie continues, "There was an odd sound that was constant throughout the podcast this week. I have nervous tics like clicking pens, cracking knuckles, and this reminded me of someone denting in a soda can or plastic bottle repeatedly. It was pretty distracting and could have been any number of things, but I thought I'd throw it out there. Keep up the good work. Love the show." To paraphrase a renowned Jedi master, "Always in motion is Tim." So that one was completely on me. I'm trying to tone it down, but I'm the fidgety type. I can't go into meetings at work because either I fall asleep or I have to doodle. One of the two. So
yeah, that's such a lie. We know you're a cokehead and you've just been sitting there snorting on lines the whole time, you know. So stop that.
Okay. Next time I'll share, Jeff. Oh, that's really
okay. Can I tell you that these jalapenos are really, really hot? I mean, really, my lips are on fire right now.
Like hotter than the Mojave hot?
Well, I don't know. Maybe it's because my lips are so chapped. Maybe that was a mistake I made.
There okay, is. Next, I. That's next too one. Easy. That's too easy. I'm not going there.
Next one's from Rick.
Well,
Jones.
You guys live there. You're in Phoenix, so it's miserable there all the time.
I like it. It's only 108.
That's because you're a shadow.
Oh, my goodness. Next.
Yeah. Next, Rick Jones, in response to questions about how Garibaldi and Sinclair met each other. He says, "This story was told in the DC Comics Babylon 5 comic book." Says, "My memory is shaky, but it was something to the effect of, Garibaldi was a shuttle pilot on Mars in the bottle. Sinclair and two red shirts hired Garibaldi to fly them around to look for some strange anomalies, and they needed a pilot familiar with the local terrain. Sinclair and Garibaldi get off to a rocky start, as Garibaldi showed up pretty hungover. However, someone fires upon their ship, and it crashed. The red shirts died, and Garibaldi and Sinclair had to walk back. On the way, they ran across a secret Psi-Corps facility, the one that had fired on them. I think the Corps were excavating a shadow vessel, and this would have been the one that led to the Icarus expedition. They were also doing some kind of experiments on telepaths. Garibaldi and Sinclair escape capture and make it home. The adventure forged a bond between them, and Garibaldi, who is narrating the story to Keffer, says that Sinclair was able to help Garibaldi get his life back on track. When they return to the crash, there is, of course, no sign of the facility or the ship. The only proof they had was a Psy-Cops badge, the one that Garibaldi shows to Sheridan and company in Messages from Earth."
Hmm. Interesting.
So, that also gets back to the whole comment, were the DC Comics part of B5 canon? And I believe they are. I think those are accepted. JMS wrote, he might have even written those groups of stories, if memory serves.
I have that whole collection, and it's just fabulous. I always was very, very impressed with it. It's not art that completely appealed to me. Like, it seemed at the time, I remember that we just felt, I felt, this is Jeffrey's opinion, I felt that we had such a great look and that the comics didn't quite capture the look, you know, the artwork.
Mm-hmm.
But all in all, I was just like, It was really, really cool to just see the comics. That was maybe, that's when I knew that, like, we really were doing something pretty cool there. When a comic comes out about your TV show, that's pretty cool.
Yes, neat. It is.
I wonder if they've collected those into, like, a graphic novel. Because I couldn't get them when they first came out. So I missed the first, what is this? It's a 4-issue?
Well, I want to say there were three sets of 4 issues. There is the 4-issue miniseries with Garibaldi and Sinclair on Mars that Rick is telling us about. There is the 4-issue miniseries, which I have, which details Sinclair's immediate arrival in Minbar as mm-hmm. ambassador. And there is, I want to say there is a third one, but I cannot remember what it is, and I haven't seen it. I'm sure there's a listener out there who will be happy to let us know what that is. But I don't know what it is.
Maybe I can dig deep at my contacts at DC Comics and see what they can say.
Oh, that would be great, yeah.
Haven't talked to them in a while, but hey, you never know.
you know, it's worth giving it a shot at this point.
I used to get to see, you just made me flash on this, I used to get to see the proofs when they would come from the publisher. They would all come to Joe for approval before they would actually go to print. I don't know whatever happened to all those, and maybe Joe's got them, but I remember that all of those things would come through. Same with the proofs, all the proofs of the B5 magazine and that sort of stuff that would all come through.
Wow.
My office first. That was cool stuff. I should have hung on to that.
Yeah. Storyboards and like proofs like that are very, very collectible in certain areas, especially if you can get the artist or the writer to sign them.
Yeah, when you're in the middle of a production like Babylon 5 and stuff, like you're not the first that we've heard saying, gosh, you know, I wish I had thought to hold on to this when things were going on. Is that just because you're so involved in the day-to-day of, you know, getting a show out on schedule, on budget, and here comes all these peripheral things, and you just want to get those done and out of the way? Is that part of the mindset there?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, because you're there to make a TV show. You're not there to make a comic book or a T-shirt or a mouse pad or, that was ancillary stuff. So it always was backseat compared to the task at hand, which was to, everybody pulled their weight to make sure that we were on track to keep the shows on schedule. So I think I agree with you. The other thing is, you know, like these proofs that I'm talking about for a comic book or a magazine, they would come through and it was like just one more thing that you kind of had to do. There wasn't the same level of, oh my gosh, I should cherish these and get the author to sign them and the illustrator to sign them because someday they'll be worth a lot and I can sell them on eBay and put my kid through college, you know. At least my mind wasn't there.
Right. Gotcha. Well, that's it for email. I just wanted to say one note of thanks to Gordon, who found himself with an extra copy of Volume 3 of the JMS Babylon 5 script books and was very generous and sent that on to me.
Nice.
I received that mail the other day and have been reading it. And I have to say, I am a script reader kind of person. You know, my feeling is that's kind of one more step toward making the finished product. You know, so on first blush, I'm very interested, of course, in Joe's introductions and his discussions of behind the scene. And at the back are some great memos of proposals for stories for the second year. But the scripts are actually kind of interesting to read through. I'm rather surprised about that.
Yeah.
So is he the first member of the Tim Callender fan club?
I don't know. You know what? I have to say it. I think my daughter probably has the number one card in that.
So Summer and I will be like number 62 and 67 or something like that, probably, right?
No, you guys could duke it out for number 2 or 3 or 23. Or
Summer, we know better. He'd never let us do that.
You know, any club I'd let you guys join, you don't want to be a part of.
Well, I have a comment here on the website, brand new, recently new anyway, to share. It relates to Jerry Doyle's radio show. Steve says, free Jerry Doyle radio show access is available through one of the affiliates, and he puts a link in here at 910knew.com. The link is actually in the comments for show 20. And he said, by the way, this will probably also work from any affiliate station that carries his show. You just click on the link and launch a live stream of his show when it's on that station. Also, regarding his politics, life imitates the B5 universe for many of the cast. Right now, Jerry is in his season 4 phase. Even though he was a lifelong Republican, he is now pissed at the Prez and has gone independent. No word of any PsyCorps involvement, though.
Ah, very interesting. All right, yeah. I'm going to have to start checking it out then.
Thanks for sending that email. I did see that when you forwarded that to me. That was pretty interesting. I have not been successful after trying a few times in being able to, but you know, as you know, I'm cyberly challenged, but I haven't been able to listen to the to Jerry's show and have wanted to repeatedly just to hear what he goes on about, because Boxleitner just thinks he's, you know, he's the shit. He's got it all going on, and his radio shows are terrific. And I'm sure there are many listeners of Jerry's show that feel the same way. I haven't been able to get it. I don't know if it was just, you know, click, download, click that I did wrong or whatever, but I wasn't able to get through on that stuff.
Well, hopefully this link will work for you.
He's such a crack-up, Doyle. I tell you what, he's one of a kind. He really, really is. He's special.
he seems like he'd be the ultimate prankster.
Yeah, but you know what? It's not that he's devious in that respect. It's that he's so stinky smart. You know, he really is. He's got a real street smart that is very clever, and his wit is so sharp, and he's so fast. We're going to get him on this show one of these days.
Sweet.
We're looking forward to that one. Absolutely.
We can't afford him, but we'll get him on this show.
That's where you and the beer comes in, Jeff.
Yeah, well, that's it. He's going to he'll be the only guest that we have on the series that will ever send me an invoice for his time.
Oh, my goodness.
All right. Well, we'll have to take up a collection from our fine listeners for that one.
We can do that. We can do that. So is that it for listener feedback?
That's it for today.
No. Well, we need more listener feedback.
All right. Well, I'm back in town now, so let's just get with the program here.
That's right. You need to get back to doing the stuff that's really important, Jeffrey. None of this producing things to earn a living or whatever it is that you're flying around the world doing and baking into Mojave and jetting into D.C. to Hobnob.
Yeah, I know. How come you didn't come to my shoot in D.C.?
Because
you don't live in D.C. Oh, well, there's that.
Well, I wasn't that far away. No, the problem was I had a manager type leaning on me very heavily to get a project done. And if I had bugged out, that probably would have been the last time that I would have seen my cube. So.
Ooh.
I know I'm being responsible. Now, you know what? On the other hand, I should have thought of this. I could have just come up there and said, Jeff, I'm unemployed. Give me a job.
There you go.
There you go. There you go. I always respond well to that.
I'm sure you do.
Well, if any of our favorite listeners or our new listeners or any listeners at all have any feedback or commentary they want to send us, the place to send that is BabylonPodcast@gmail.com, or you can call our voicemail number at 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
The year the Great War came upon us all.
And we will see you next time on the other side of the gate.
The preceding program is part of the Farpoint Media family of podcasts. To find out more about Farpoint Media and the many other podcasts available, visit www.farpointmedia.net. A world of audio wonder awaits you there.